This is the Business Report with Gary Strubel on Nova 1035.
Tomorrow's Black Friday, that makes it Grey Thursday, but we'll brighten it up a little bit. We have got a packed show for you on the Business Report this evening in the spotlight. We speak to Tian Bazain, the CEO of the NSX. We've got a reply from the Omeya's Homeowners Association, or a representative of homeowners from the Omeya Golf and Lifestyle Estate, on a story we ran last week around the issues surrounding that particular development. We talk about problems at the port. We'll talk to Alec Hogg about another crazy week in South Africa. We also catch up with Roland Brown in the NSX Market Watch, and we'll chat a little bit about Trusco and their woes, and also how MTC have fared in a week of trading as their shares listed on Friday. So lots to look forward to. So let's get right into it with the Biz News Flash Briefing.
Rebuilding the economy starts now. RMB Namibia Corporate and Investment Banking, proud partner of Biz News.
The Helen Suzman Foundation, the DA and AfriForum have approached the courts to have Jacob Zuma sent back to jail, saying that there has been absolutely no indication that the former president is terminally ill, making the granting of his medical parole unlawful. The former president spent 1 month in escort prison in July, was moved to hospital in August and released on medical parole in September. The groups argued in court on Tuesday that the medical parole was granted against the recommendation of the Medical Parole Board and that Zuma's outings after being released were proof that he was fine. Zuma's lawyers called the applicants racist and right-wing. No specific ailments were mentioned, but the legal team said Zuma needs 24-hour care that he couldn't get in jail. The Department of Home Affairs is fighting to stop fraud-accused Atul Gupta from attaining a South African passport, saying that a last such would be akin to enabling him to travel and, in effect, assist him in escaping criminal prosecution in South Africa. Gupta is currently a fugitive from justice with a warrant out for his arrest. He faces charges of fraud and money laundering under the Prevention of Organized Crime Act. An application for a new South African passport was dismissed earlier this year, and Gupta's legal team has applied to have the decision overturned. Home Affairs said that fugitives have no standing to litigate in the country's courts. With councils now established in all three major metros in Gauteng, the DA has emerged as the biggest winner, taking leadership roles in Johannesburg, Tshwane, and Ekurhuleni. However, the victory comes with a caveat that the roles come as a result of smaller political parties with no formal coalition agreements in place. The party will need to lobby smaller players to pass important things like budgets and policies, which could result in very volatile governance over the next 5 years. The ANC, meanwhile, has been left licking its wounds with reports of infighting and turmoil within its ranks in Gauteng.
A sudden storm shouldn't disrupt your long-term outlook. Access RMB's flexible short-term liquidity. Rebuilding our economy starts now. RMB Namibia, a division of First National Bank of Namibia Limited.
Gary Strubel on the Business Report.
Time now for your lead story on the Nova Business Report. The lead story is proudly brought to you by Alexander Forbes. Alexander Forbes, let us help you secure your financial well-being now and in the future.
This is the Business Report on Nova 1035 and a follow-up on a story that we ran last week where we spoke to Daniel Tablanche, a director of the company that effectively runs the Omeya Golf and Lifestyle Estate. And there were a couple of statements that Daniel made that upset some of the homeowners. And we got some calls, and thank you very much for listening, for those of you out there listening to Nova. And so we said, great, let's get the homeowners guys in and let's have a bit of a chat. And we're still trying to unpack, and I think for many people, trying to understand exactly what the situation is at the moment. Joining me here in the studio is Peter De Beer, a lawyer who represents a number of homeowners, been given a mandate by over 220 homeowners to represent their view in this unfolding saga. So Peter, firstly, welcome to the studio.
Thank you. Thanks for having me.
Okay, so let's just try and unpack where we are. There were a couple of things Daniel said last week that seemed to upset some of the homeowners. One of them, and I'll perhaps just seed you on that, was that a small number of homeowners are obstructing progress because they seem to not trust him enough. That was kind of what he said. Guys had strong feelings about that.
Yes, the small number is not correct. There was an invitation from the directors that homeowners can present them with questions that they have. And a group of 35 homeowners got together, compiled a list of questions and forwarded that. But that was not representative of all the homeowners. So the small group comes from that 35 number.
Okay.
But that is not, it's more than 50% people that instructed me or that I represent that are concerned about the developments at Umeya.
Okay. And just briefly then, the other 50% are not concerned?
Well, some of them choose not to get involved for personal reasons. Some of them decline to support the process of the concerned homeowners. But we haven't embarked on a search to find out who's with us or who's not.
Fair enough. So last week, the story that sort of started this little investigation of ours was over 90 plots were being put on auction. We're assuming as an attempt to raise some capital for the estate or for whoever the debtor is or the developer at the moment. Firstly, that seemed to be what was happening. How did that auction go? Do you guys know how it went?
Yes, I was present there at the auction. I did not register, but there was five bidders that registered to bid. No plots came up. No one made an offer. And no sale took place or offer awarded to any purchaser or bidder last week, Friday, on the 19th.
All right, so that didn't solve anything. We're back to where we were before that situation.
Yes, the whole auction process also involved 2 days of online bidding. And what I understand, people at the auction ask, I want to bid on this property, and it says, no, it's already sold. So I assume that some of the property was sold online before.
Okay, but none at the event itself.
Right? Not so at the event, yeah.
We'll have to go and follow up and see what the actual result is. We'll reach out to the estate on that. Okay, so let's unpack this a little bit. There is then a relatively large group of homeowners, significantly more than 50%, that feel that the current plan as being espoused by the directors of the Golf and Lifestyle Estate, we're assuming under the instruction or under the guidance of Bank Vintook, are not happy with what's being proposed. So perhaps as shortly as you can, as simply as you can, just explain to us what they're not happy with.
Yes, the perception that the homeowners do not trust the directors of the developer, Ogro, that is the Umeya Residential Estate, is true. The history is not conducive. It was not transparent. But the main concern at the moment is the homeowners looking at the situation that the business rescue plan involves that a further 65 million is invested that would eventually end up at the major creditors, that is Bank Vintook, who's the major with FNB. And the only outcome would be that the levies will increase. The cash flow that was presented to some of the homeowners of this Umeya infrastructure company can only be viable if the levies increase significantly.
And that obviously is a cause for long-term concern for your investment.
That is a concern because the stability of levies has been a problem at Umeya for some time. It is not a spend on actual costs. We don't know, or the homeowners don't know, on what it is, what is the cost price. If a pipe burst, if the sewerage system packs up, how much does it cost to maintain it? And that is the problem, that there's a percentage of the levies that would go for profit of that infrastructure company. And that should not happen.
Okay. So if I understand things, this has obviously got a long convoluted history and you've taken me through some of the things off air. State was set up, a whole lot of money went in, a whole lot of sales were made. Some money has gone out of the system. And now that's the money that everyone's looking for. And what the major creditors are doing are turning around saying, not sure where to get this money from, so we're going to go after the homeowners because they are vested and therefore they are the easiest target. Is that the feeling that you're getting?
That is the feeling that we are getting. We hear words that levies won't go up and then it changed, but there's no commitment. And we've asked their business plan, that we can look at the model and see how is this going to affect the homeowners in the future. And looking at that model, that kite is not going to fly.
Is one of the options not that the homeowners be given the opportunity to buy the estate so that they are fully vested?
Well, that is definitely an option worthwhile investigated. It's, however, difficult to get 400 people to agree on it, and they don't want to replace one devil with the next devil. So there's a lot of technicality and complications if the homeowners bought the estate or the infrastructure of the estate.
Understand it. So are the homeowners in a position to block the current path that things are taking?
No, they're not. They are totally in the hands of the developer, which appears now to be in control by the major creditors, Bankwindhoek and FNB. And the only option would be to follow a legal suit to block that. I'm a believer in negotiations and talk and sit around a table, but for more than a year now, we've been trying to get the decision makers to talk to us, and they made commitments, yes, they will, and then nothing happened thereafter.
And this is obviously leading to a lot of frustration that's now coming to a head because things are starting to happen.
Yes, and there's a suspicion now. If you don't want to talk to the homeowners, what is wrong? What are you hiding? And that is not conducive for the progress at the Maya.
So apart from a class action type or a group action type legal route, what other options do the homeowners have at the moment if they're staring down both barrels? They can't sell. The rumors are no one's going to buy because the levies are going to be ridiculous. So they're stuck in their investment. And what options do they have?
Well, the options, the one that is quite, I get frequently asked about it, whether they can refuse to pay levies and just pay the creditors as it arrives. But that would be wrong because they've committed to pay levies.
Sure.
So it would be a tax association where you have in other parts of the world where people refuse to pay city tax to block the authority from taking steps. I think that would not be, it would not be lawful.
Tough situation. So Peter, yes. Representing these homeowners, what is an ideal outcome for you? What are you hoping happens?
Well, I hope the decision takers at Bankwindhoek sit around the table with a group of representatives of the homeowners and not the business rescue experts. They are there to seek financing to get a cash flow going. To have an end result is that the stability of the levies would ensure stability of the estate, and that will increase the value of the properties. And I think one can talk about it and sort it out. What we cannot sort out is the 38 million that was invested and another 65 million that is flowing. And there has been no benefit to the homeowners.
Okay.
One cannot have a third party paying the debt of another party, and the third party was not involved in that wheeling and dealing.
Well, we hope the decision makers are listening, and we hope you guys are able to resolve it. It is certainly the kind of development that Vintok can't afford to allow to fail for long-term economic investment and further investment in developments in town.
Well, it's a fantastic place to live. There's no doubt about it. With the golf estate, there's nothing wrong with the idea. It's just that money and the flow of money that was not transparent spoiled now the progress. Since the developer asked for liquidation, a provisional judicial manager was appointed, and the directors of the Homeowners Association resigned, and he appointed homeowners. And the trust came back. People actually purchased property. They invested. New houses went up. And everyone was positive. Now, a couple of months later, those directors were gotten written off. And we're back at where the interest of the Homeowners Association is different from the developer and different from the major creditors. And that conflict of interest, separate people must represent separate parties.
Peter De Beer, representing nearly 60% of homeowners on the Amagolf Lifestyle Estate, in response to a story that we ran last week with Donaldson Blanche, who's currently the director, effectively the managing director of the Omea Golf and Lifestyle. We'll continue to track this story and bring you updates as and when they happen. Peter De Beer, thank you very much for speaking to us.
Thank you.
The lead story was proudly brought to you by Alexander Forbes. Alexander Forbes, let us help you secure your financial well-being now and in the future.
It's the Business Report with Gary Struble. Namibia's business leader on Nova 1035.
Welcome back to the Business Report, right here on Nova 1035. And now it's time for the Business Report Spotlight, which is brought to you as always by the Safland Property Group. Safland Property Group, a leading provider of property services since 1992. And welcome to the Spotlight to Tian Bazain, the CEO of the NSX. Tian, welcome to the show.
Thank you very much for having me.
It's an honor to have the guy running the financial future of Namibia, as the markets are often considered to capitalists, on the show with us. And we'll start out a little bit before we get to your day job. Let's talk a little bit about Tian the guy. It's a tough gig starting a stock exchange in what would be, I suppose, regarded as a tertiary market to most. So what led here? How did you get into this position? What did you study and how did you get into the financial sector?
Well, I mean, it's a story you probably couldn't plan. I started off, I studied economics and law, became a legal practitioner in the High Court of Namibia, started off as a public prosecutor all over the north of the country, from Grootfontein to Oshakati, ended up as a magistrate in Windhoek, and then did my bar exams. From there, I went into banking, first with Bank Windhoek, and then got asked to join the team for the second mobile operator in Namibia, being Cell One at the time.
Yeah.
That got part of the process of selling that to the Egyptians when it became Leo. And after that transaction, joined the NSX, first as listings manager and then taking over as CEO. So I certainly didn't start the exchange. Mm-hmm. A lot of credit goes to a lot of other people there. But that's where I ended up there.
So as a magistrate, surely in a town like Windhoek, you get a lot of respect. What made you go out of that sort of gig?
Well, respect is nice, but that's not necessarily where you want to spend the rest of your career either. I did that for long enough for that to have taught me what I got out of that. But public service, of course, I think is important for everyone, especially if you're going to deal with government going forward. You appreciate a lot more when you've been on the inside.
Sure. Do you feel responsible in some way for the sort of economic health of the country, given your position? Is that something you think about?
It's certainly something I think about. And as an organization, we try to be proactive in the sense that we can add value. And, you know, you've got so many competing interests, and government often gets stuck in the middle there. In terms of which interest to place first. So on the macroeconomic side, we certainly try to add value when it comes to new pieces of legislation that have a financial impact. We also try to help there, not just me, but also, you know, we have a lot of expertise in-house and also with our board. So, we try to help as much and to give as much input as we can.
So let's perhaps just get a view from you now. You mentioned macroeconomic policies and so forth. Namibia, given the size of the economy, there's an overwhelming feeling of nationalism and patriotism amongst many financial services people that to try and keep things as Namibian as they can. And then obviously there's the overriding globalization that continues to expand outwards. How do you balance those two things when giving advice to people looking to list or looking to attract capital to Namibia?
Look, I think there's a very fine balance. We don't just want to have an economy that is owned and operated by outside interests. So we certainly want to grow our own capacity, And we want to nurture our new and current Namibian businesses to expand and to be to someday be those big organizations that expand into other countries. But we also need to be pragmatic because our addressable market within Namibia is quite small compared to a province in South Africa would have a bigger population than we would have, but we'd have triple the transport costs. So we need to be pragmatic where we can work together with other organizations, companies, etc. I'll give you that example that we in the NSX make use of the Johannesburg Stock Exchange trading system. So we run it, we regulate it, we surveillance it, we do all of the work in-house. But it's not necessary for us to go and buy a trading system, which would have been very costly and would have required additional funding. So you need to look where you can leverage off existing infrastructure and create smart partnerships to make it work within a smaller economy.
So part of the spotlight, Tian, is to get a bit of a glimpse of the people behind the news. And there's no better glimpse you can get into a man's soul than asking him to pick a song. Tell us a little bit about the song you've selected.
It's one of my all-time classic ones that I love. It's Metallica, Nothing Else Matters.
Something
That's Metallica right here on Nova 103.5, an absolute classic from them, and a song that made it into the Nova Top 200 in our contest that we ran a few weeks ago. Brilliant, brilliant cut and choice tonight of Tian Bazane, the CEO of the NSX, the Namibian Stock Exchange, who's joining us in the spotlight tonight. Tian, let's turn our attention now to the work you do every day, which is running the stock exchange. What are some of the challenges, the biggest challenges that the stock exchange faces in a world where technology is changing much faster than most systems and certainly most laws can keep up with?
Well, as a core function, the stock exchange is there to deepen and to diversify the capital market options for the Namibian public as well as our institutional funders. So deepening is specifically bringing more Namibian companies to market. And that's certainly a challenge. I think there's often misconceptions about giving up control with family-owned businesses when you go public. And that's partially probably a lack of information that leads to that understanding. The truth is much research and statistics have shown that a listed company outperforms a privately owned company every time. And that's because you are, to some extent, forced to listen to other voices as well. Typically, an owner-operated business, the owner himself makes all the decisions, whether they're right or wrong, without having to consult with anybody else or take any other views into account. And that turns out to be a better process in the long term for companies. And then on the diversification side, obviously, we have some technological constraints because we do not yet have a central securities depository, which means that you have electronic ownership reflection and no longer certificates. That's something we hope to implement next year.
Okay, so let's talk about that. You're talking about obviously a process of whereby you no longer hold a piece of paper saying you have 50 or 100 shares in a company. It instead sits on a database somewhere. And you have an account that gives you a kind of a state, much as what's happened to banking accounts now, that where most of it is digital. What is the process that needs to be followed? That's quite a radical departure for certainly older investors, where holding the piece of paper was important. What sort of process needs to be followed to get the stock exchange to that point?
Okay, so historically, we've been waiting for the Financial Institutions Markets Bill, which has now been enacted. We are in process of finalizing the license requirements on that, and we've already appointed a vendor, and we've established a company for the Central Securities Depository together with Bank of Namibia. They're our partner in this process. So we've actually done a lot of work already, but going live with it next year, if we get the license, is going to be quite a departure, as you say. We're not going to force people to dematerialize, so the public participants who have a piece of paper that they're comfortable with, that they keep in the vault or keep under the bed, that's fine. But we will get to a point where if you want to trade, you will have to dematerialize first.
Okay. And is it a costly exercise for the exchange, or will it wind up being cheaper?
Well, I think due to the fact that we've been waiting for so long after having contracted with a vendor some time ago, it's certainly cheaper than it would have been if we had to contract now. So the exchange, having been a not-for-profit organization for a long time and having built up reserves during that period, has committed to fund the project. Like I say, Bank of Namibia came on board and committed to fund it as well. So this is not something that has a profit motive behind it that we have to squeeze out of clients. It's a financial market infrastructure that the country and the economy needs. So the funding is not being considered on a purely commercial basis.
So let's talk about that for a second, because obviously one of the chief benefits of dematerialization is just the speed at which transactions can take place and the ease of access for smaller investors. Is it a consideration for the stock exchange that, you know, the current offering is quite laborious, and this is a critical way to get or to give access to smaller investors to the stock exchange?
That's part of it, but that's not the real reason. The biggest reason is it takes out a lot of risk out of the process of clearing and settlement. So currently you've got a process where a trade will take place, then the certificate literally has to be brought in, cancelled, and a new certificate issued. During that entire process, there's a risk. If any of the top participants don't comply with their clearing and settlement obligations, with a CSD, it all becomes electronic, and it can actually confirm that you do own the shares when the trade is being done and that the funds are at the other side of the trade. And if we take that risk component out of the market, we actually open our market up to a lot of international investors who cannot invest in our current paper system.
That would certainly change the game for the exchange. All right, lastly, a big event for the stock exchange over the last couple of weeks. We don't see listings every day, so and the biggest listing ever. So I suppose it's congratulations to the whole team at the NSX for being a part of such a massive listing. You guys proud of what you've been able to do with MTC?
Yeah, look, obviously it's been a great success. It's not the biggest listing, it's the biggest capital raising in one go. So we've had bigger companies literally come to market, but they didn't sell off as much as was the case in this sure. listing. So government sold off their stake in the business. They raised $2.5 billion in the process. That's a substantial amount for the size of our economy, for the size of our exchange. That is truly a milestone. So, yes, of course, very happy with that. The discussions around listing state-owned enterprises has been coming along for a very long time. And I'm personally quite proud that we've gotten to the point of listing one. I hope we'll see more. All of them wouldn't necessarily be in the same position as MTC was now, but certainly there are state-owned enterprises that have the potential to come to market and for private interests to take over those sides of the business, where governments need to focus on places where the market is not providing services.
Well, we hope we see them for you, Tian. To you and your team, congratulations on such a big listing, and certainly as a state-owned enterprise, a big moment in the development of the economy as well. Thank you for being in the spotlight here on Nova 103.5. This Business Report Spotlight was brought to you by Safland Property Group. Safland Property Group, offering the widest range of property services in Namibia.
The Business Report. The Business Report.
This is the Business Report on Nova 103.5. Welcome back. And now time for my favorite part of the show. We get to chat to Alec Hogg in the BizNews Weekly Wrap. And this weekly wrap is brought to you by APS, African Personnel Services. We work for you. Alec, as always, welcome to the show. It's been a busy week in South Africa. Lots of big things happening and lots of malcontent around politics and stuff around the environment. And as always, Magnus Hastings upset about stuff. So what's your biggest story of the week?
Helen Ziller, unquestionably. I got hold of her at about 6:15 one morning this week, and on WhatsApp, and said, "Can you talk about the strange things that have happened?" This is on the 22nd, on Monday. There was an unprecedented voting for new mayors, where it was a anyone but the ANC approach, And she did. So I spoke to her early on Tuesday morning, just after the DA had been given the right to appoint, well, had voted in the mayor of Johannesburg and Ekurhuleni, which were huge surprises. They got the support there of Action SA and the EFF. And Helen unpacked everything really well. And that's without question our top story, because South Africans are tired of corruption, particularly in the major metros, and no doubt elsewhere in the country as well, in the municipalities, where it has really been a opportunity by the ANC just to plunder for many years now. And getting a new government, even though it's going to be a pretty dicey one because it's a minority government in Johannesburg and Ekurhuleni, and then consequently on Tuesday, the DA also got the mayor of Pretoria, or Tshwane rather, and that does mean that the three major councils in Gauteng are under the DA control, and of course add Cape Town, and you've got the four biggest in the country now, which are sitting with it, with the DA, with the exception of eThekwini or Durban, where the ANC squeaked in by, I think it was 7 votes. But it's all change in politics in South Africa. And Helen was, I think, gave us quite a lot of reasons for sobriety and no reason to celebrate this yet, because there's an enormous amount of work going forward. And who knows, she said at any point the EFF might change their collective mind, and that would be the end of the mayor who was appointed at that point, at that stage, and chaos will reign again. So we are in completely uncharted waters here in South Africa after the local government elections.
So you speak of uncharted waters. The Rand is in uncharted waters. That's a story from Treasury One on your site, and the forecast doesn't look good for the Rand going forward. Mostly dollar strength at the moment, and uncertainty around inflation in the major markets, but what is the current thinking about the direction of the Rand?
Well, the Rand is now heading back towards 16 against the US dollar, and it's not an unusual place for the Rand to be. It bounces all over the place, Gary, and I think all we do, the one thing we do know, being in South Africa, is that the Rand will be volatile. And if it shows a period of strength, it's a very good idea to take the money and invest offshore, because the weakness will follow as sure as night follows day. The guys at Treasury One, and you're talking specifically there about Andre Celia, he's called the Rand really well. When he's nervous, we're right to be nervous as well. And it is heading again in the wrong direction for the moment.
And a story that caught my attention, and we've seen a number of issues pop up on social media around it, is, of course, Shell and their ambitions to do some exploration off the Wild Coast. It seems to have sparked some fury. Perhaps you can just shed some light on what are they proposing, because the story on your site talks about the other side of the sonar exploration argument. Perhaps just give us some insights what's going on there.
Well, you might recall, if you go back decades in South Africa, the one weakness of the country as far as self-sufficiency is concerned is oil and gas. During the apartheid regime, the Karoo was pockmarked with exploratory wells to try and find oil and gas within the country. Then in the Southern Cape, there was quite a lot of searching for oil or gas, which, it was very difficult to discover because the seas there are extremely rough. And they did find some oil off Mossel Bay, but it wasn't enough by far to get South Africa self-sufficient. But all the geological surveys would suggest, or those that exist at the moment, that South Africa does have offshore resources. There's been some good finds off Mossel Bay. Technology has improved dramatically in the exploration area as well as being able to pull gas out from rough seas. A few years ago, Total managed to extract gas from the North Sea and used similar technology off Mossel Bay, well, the Southern Cape coast, to discover some really huge gas fields, not as big as Mozambique, but in South Africa's situation, unprecedented. Anyway, this has sparked a lot of interest from one of its competitors, Shell, and Shell's now going further up the coast towards the Wild Coast. That's off the Eastern Cape rather than the Southern Cape. And there's been a furore because of the way that Shell is exploring for the oil and gas. It hasn't been properly surveyed in that area. It was never really considered as a oil or gas province up until this point. And the technology that's being used is believed by a lot of environmentalists to be very damaging, not just to the ocean, but to marine life. And we published something earlier this week after an old pal of mine, Peter Bruce, wrote an article in the Sunday Times. Peter's from that area, from the Eastern Cape. So I thought he was being a little emotional perhaps about it. But the video that we published was quite powerful against Shell. And then this morning, because that's the way, that's what you do as a publication, as a journalist, you give the other side. So we've got a other point of view on the exploration on the sonar, which says it isn't that dangerous. What I'm still not sure about is the argument here is that you're not allowed to do this kind of exploration in the Atlantic or in Europe, but it appears as though you're allowed to do it in the Indian Ocean, which seems to be double standards, but I haven't had confirmation on whether that is true. But that's what the environmental lobby says. Why are you doing stuff here which has been banned in the Northern Hemisphere? So we'll get to the bottom of it at some point in time, but there's always two sides to every story, isn't there, Gary?
And it's great to find both of those on the website, biznews.com. You can go check out those stories and more. Lots of videos, lots of audio from Alec and his intrepid team of journalists from all over the world as they bring you all sorts of great information here from our little tip of Africa. And that's this week's BizNews Weekly Wrap, brought to you by APS, African Personnel Services. We work for you.
Gary Struble on the Business Report.
And now, right, you're on the Business Report. It's time for the NSX Market Watch. The NSX Market Watch is brought to you by Express Credit, money when you need it most. Joining me today for the Market Watch is the very well-known Roland Brown from Cirrus Capital. Roland, welcome to the show.
Thanks a lot. Thanks for having me.
Brilliant. Well, let's get into it. A couple of things to touch on. It was MTC's first week of trading on the NSX. Your thoughts? How did it go? Was it as expected?
Well, not quite a full week yet. I think it listed Friday last week, so still a day of trading to go. But I think pretty much as expected, once we saw the results of the IPO and the fact that there wasn't full subscription on the IPO, then it was fairly obvious that there wouldn't be a huge amount of action post-listing. So basically anyone that wanted to buy will have done so on the IPO. So there's not really much in the way of buyers in the market now. So we saw a bit of trading. It did pretty much exactly the same as what Standard Bank did after its IPO. So it traded up slightly on very, very thin volumes. Now it's traded back down to 870, it listed at 850. So now it's down to 876. We think that volumes will be very depressed now for a while still. It's very unlikely that there's going to be big volumes going through unless the price comes off quite a bit, which is what we expect over the next couple of months. And I think this is really informed by the fact that the people that did want to buy at 850 did so on the IPO. So now I think there will be some buying volumes, but probably a bit lower down. And then as the people that bought on the IPO, particularly the retail investors, realize that it's not going to go up dramatically and slowly start trying to turn that illiquid share or their illiquid holding of that share into cash again, you'll see it coming off a bit.
So perhaps just in simple terms, a lot of capital was raised. Is this a successful listing?
It depends how you look at it. I mean, I think it would be wrong to say it's not successful. It's, you know, by far the biggest listing that's ever taken place on the exchange. And so I think from that perspective, it's successful. But I think, you know, just trying to raise $3 and a bit billion out of this small economy without really putting a lot of effort into bringing foreign investors in is a tall order, as MTCX has illustrated. I think for the retail investors, particularly that have a bit of a shorter time horizon that they look at, I think the next few months might be a bit painful. And as a result of that, I think they may not look at it as a success. But as far as the exchange is concerned, as far as the deepening of the financial markets here and the exchange specifically is concerned, I think it's been quite successful.
Brilliant. Well, a long graft ahead for the MTC guys now as they into the world of being listed and being watched and being asked all the time. Let's turn our attention to another company that doesn't particularly like being asked things. An adverse finding for Trusco from the JSE this week. Their request for reconsideration of a finding that they needed to restate their financials was rejected by the tribunal. They've got 6 months to appeal, but that's got to be seen as a bit of a blow to their, perhaps a further blow to their credibility on the JSE. We know they were threatened with suspension last year and again this year. So just your thoughts on that. Are they handling this correctly?
Well, I mean, I think the tribunal has made it clear that they haven't been handling their financials correctly, and that's not an insignificant accusation to make for sure. And our sort of high-level adjustment, our high-level calculation on what the adjustment will be suggests that there will be about a $1.7 billion adjustment to their equity. And I think at the last set of results that they released, they weren't sitting on that much equity. It was 2.6 billion. So a reduction of 1.7 out of 2.6 is a very substantial reduction. And it'll leave the company with something in the region of 980 million of equity. Now, just to be clear, that's our high level calculation. It's quite complicated. So we may be off slightly, but it should be something in that region. So it's a very big adjustment. And I mean, if you take that and the implication that has on the ratios of the company, like the price to book and similar, it's very significant. I think, you know, it's something that we've been expecting for a while, not maybe this specifically, but generally there's been, I think, a little bit beyond what one can view as realistic and legitimate in terms of the quantum of non-cash adjustments and so on that are being put through the income statement that always make the company look profitable, or yeah, in this instance, actually go from what would appear to be material loss to profitable. But it's non-cash things. So obviously that is legitimate. If the value of your house goes up, you know, 5% and you adjust the value of your house on your balance sheet up 5%, it would, you know, go through your income statement. Sure. It's kind of equivalent. And that's legitimate, but you know, there is a degree to, you know, there is a point at which you sort of pushing the limits of what is sort of realistic and what is legitimate. And I think that they've been doing that for quite a few years now. So, I mean, we've talked about it a number of times. It incurs quite a lot of wrath from them, or it's, you know, they don't take it too well. But I think for the retail investor particularly, it's quite important that they, you know, need to be aware of the fact that this is one of those instances where not all that glitters is gold. So it's just important to kind of keep an eye on it. On this instance, maybe not all that glitters is diamonds, but you get the idea.
Well, perhaps just staying with Trusco for a second, the day before this finding came out, there was a restatement of a cautionary that had been stated twice already about a management control shift to a company called Next Capital. You got any details on that?
Not really. I mean, I don't think that there's that much clarity on it. But Next is the company that has been managing Trusco for a while, and it has this management agreement in place with Trusco. The challenge that we've always had with that is that the management agreement is linked to revenue, amongst other things. And, you know, revenue can be sort of fairly theoretical in some ways. And, you know, I think what you can end up with happening is that the cash that is generated gets kind of siphoned off, and, you know, the rest of the shareholders are left with a lot of the non-cash stuff. And that's obviously not desirable. But I haven't followed, or we don't have that much detail on what the changes are now. The other thing that's been in the press around, or on sense around the company for a while, has been or for the past couple of months has been a sort of divorce, let's say, between them and Conduit. So that's the other kind of thing that we've been quite interested in. That's been the two companies and their sort of respective representatives, have moved quite closely together. So the divorce of the two is quite interesting and I think going to have quite a big impact on share prices and so on.
Thanks, Roland. Anything else this week that caught your eye on the markets?
It's been a bit of a quiet week. I think the big thing really is the blowout in the rand that we've seen. The hike, the sort of surprise hike in South Africa and the subsequent rand action, quite interesting. We think that the rand will weaken a little bit still, but then after that, should start to see some strength coming through. The other big thing is, you know, whether the Namibian Central Bank is going to follow South Africa next month and hike rates as well, which we're sort of in two minds about. We don't think that the bank should, but if the SARB hikes again in January, then it'll leave us with a negative differential, which is something that we don't like to have and something that we don't like to see sustained for any period of time. So we hope that the central bank here doesn't hike. And then that the SARB doesn't hike at the next meeting, which we think is unlikely. So I think, yeah, hopefully we won't see higher rates here just yet.
Let's hope not. Roland Brown from Cirrus Capital, thank you very much for your thoughts. That is the NSX Market Watch this week, brought to you by Express Credit. Money when you need it most.
The Business Report. Podcasts on nova.com.na. The Business Report. Thursdays from 6 to 7 on Nova 1035.
So, two trends here. One of them being Black Friday over the last decade has grown enormously in significance as a worldwide retail phenomenon. And then the second is driven by trends, but also COVID-19 last year, online shopping growing, even here in Namibia, where there are a number of small startups that have tried to get into the space and a couple of the big corporates as well. So it's Black Friday tomorrow. We wanted to find out what you need to be careful of. Angie Skoltz caught up with Arthur Goldstuck.
Good afternoon, Arthur. Do you think COVID is going to lead to more people shopping online this Black Friday? And if so, is an increase in cybercrime inevitable?
There's no question that people are going to be turning to online sales for Black Friday deals this year as a result of COVID because they are nervous of the big crowds that can be expected in stores. So yes, there will be big crowds, but there'll be even bigger crowds online. So people will have to be sharp to catch limited deals as they become available. But having said that, the cyber criminals are also on the lookout for these crowds arriving online. And they are going to be looking to find ways to scam people.
What are some of the things that people can do to protect themselves becoming a victim?
The most important things that people can do to protect themselves revolve around being aware of the fact that there are scams out there. So, for example, if it's too good to be true, if it's just a crazy deal, then just make 100% sure that it's a legitimate site, that the site address is the correct address for the brand that is supposedly making the sale, and that everything else looks legitimate as well. So, for example, in the website address, there's usually a prefix that goes http://. That's how most web addresses start. But if it's an e-commerce site, it will have an S on top of the HTTP. So it'll start HTTPS. And that means that it's got a security certificate, which means typically that it's on a secure server. And that is the hallmark of legitimate e-commerce businesses. If it doesn't have that S on the end of HTTP, then you should be very wary. And you need to be 100% sure that it's a legitimate site. Then the second thing people must look out for is whether it's a fake website that is designed to steal their details. So a lot of phishing happens around this time of year. Phishing spelled PH, phishing, and that refers to people receiving scam emails that offer them incredible deals or never-to-be-repeated offers and the like, and invite them to click through to the website. So when you receive those, firstly, you should be very wary in the first place and not click through unless you're expecting an email or you know who it's from or you regularly get this email because you subscribe to a service. But if it comes out of the blue, then chances are it's a phishing email. And then when you click through, it's going to ask for your personal details. And then you've got to be double careful because generally speaking, that's how people's credit card details and passwords are collected online. So again, unless you're 100% sure that it is the legitimate site and that you were supposed to receive that email in the first place, don't input your personal details on a website that could be fake.
Interesting. In terms of online shopping, are local sites safer to buy from than international ones, or is it the other way around?
You can be scammed as much on local sites as international sites. The big difference, though, is that when you know a local site, if you shop on a site that you know and that you've been to before or regularly, then you'll also know what the service levels are and who to contact if anything goes wrong. So most of the bigger sites locally will have some kind of support system where you know that you can get a refund or you can return the goods if they're not appropriate. With international purchases, you don't have those same benefits. Typically, you can't easily send something back, and also it's more difficult to track down anyone who can assist you if you have queries or issues.
Let's talk passwords quickly. Are super long words with a mix of capital and lowercase letters, symbols and numbers still a thing, or should we be looking at passphrases instead?
Passphrases work best because you can remember them. If it's a password that you can't remember, then chances are you're going to land up in trouble anyway because even though no one else will be able to guess them, you yourself might not be able to remember them. And that means you can't get into your own account.
What about things like free Wi-Fi in shopping malls? If I'm in a store and I see they have a better deal online, is it safe to use the mall's internet?
Mall internet is incredibly dangerous, as is any public Wi-Fi, because it's very possible for anyone to sit in that mall and create a fake hotspot where you log on to their hotspot thinking that it's the mall's Wi-Fi, and now you're giving your passwords and details and anything else that you input when you're visiting a website, you're actually giving it to the hackers who have created that fake hotspot. So if you are using mall Wi-Fi, firstly, make dead sure that it is the legitimate Wi-Fi hotspot, because usually there'll be signs around telling you what the hotspot name is. And if the name is different, then that's usually a warning sign. That's the first thing. The second thing is people need to learn to use something called a VPN, a virtual private network, which even if they're going to a fake website, the content that you're posting can't be intercepted by the hackers sitting behind the fake hotspot.
Lastly, what should people do if they think they have been a victim of cybercrime?
If people feel that their credit card has been compromised, they must instantly report it to their bank or the credit card company, because that way you can block the card, but also you can ensure that fraudulent use of your card is reversed. So one has to be very keenly aware of any alerts that money has been spent on your credit card. If you feel that your account on any website has been compromised, then you should immediately change the password on that site.
That's Angie Scholz from Future Media News talking to legendary technology commentator Arthur Goldstuck.
It's the Business Report with Gary Strubel. This is the Business Report on Nova 1035.
So it's been a busy show, but it's also been a busy couple of months around the world as all over the world, stock shortages and shipping problems have pervaded. The shipping industry globally is experiencing shortage of empty containers, and southern African ports have not been spared. The crisis has ascended, firstly, due to the decrease in the number of available containers. Most ports were congested as the number of labourers was reduced. Thirdly, a drop in the number of ships operating. And fourthly, the impact of consumer buying patterns as societies experienced often rolling lockdowns and also uncertainty about their employment have severely hindered shipping line of business. We checked in with Tania Pessart, the Corporate Communications Manager at Namport, and asked her if that was the case at Walvis Bay.
That is correct. We have been experiencing shortages of containers since late last year, let's say from November 2020 already. It's a global container shortage. What is happening due to the COVID-19 pandemic and not all ports being opened, some ports have actually closed because the employees were affected with COVID-19 and goods could not be offloaded as fast as possible. And therefore, this has caused a global container shortage. But we're working together with our stakeholders and clients to service them as best as we possibly can. Since the start of this COVID-19 pandemic, the American consumers have continued to consume, even though they have been working from home, they've been buying office furniture, they've also been redecorating their houses during this whole time and actually spending money. So therefore, the demand in terms of the global consumerism, America has really taken the forefront in terms of still ordering goods and so forth. So the most busiest route at the moment globally is from Asia to America. And that is why you're seeing that LA ports and Long Beach ports are actually congested at the moment. Container ships are standing by in order to offload all the containers. And that means that all the private terminal operators are working 24/7 to ensure that all these containers are offloaded in order to meet the demand of Christmas goods, especially toys, electronics, and clothes. And this route has become so profitable that we have more and more ships servicing this route. And that is why there are fewer ships being deployed at this point in time to African ports. And that is why we're currently experiencing a global container shortage. So in essence, our whole global shipping industry is transforming at the moment. It's going through a transformation process and evolving. And we are sure within the next 2 years, this shipping disruption and this American demand will actually subside. Thank you very much.
The Business Report. Thursdays from 6 to 7 on Nova 1035.
I'm David Bishop with your weekly economics wrap. Starting off with some good news, the Hospitality Association of Namibia released their tourism accommodation statistics for October 2021, showing an average room occupancy of 34% across the country, which is an improvement on July's 12% and more than double those of October 2020, when only 14.45% was recorded. The Ministry of Environment, Forestry and Tourism has also developed a draft tourism sector recovery plan for 2022-24 to help ignite the recovery process of the tourism sector from the impacts of the COVID-19 pandemic. Meanwhile, on Thursday, the port of Walvis Bay saw the return of a cruise liner for the first time since 2020, when the MS Europa docked carrying 408 passengers and a crew of 276. In other local news, Minister of Labour, Industrial Relations and Employment Creation, Utoni Nyoma, has said the ministry is undertaking ambitious measures to eliminate delays during the dispute resolution process. Popular Democratic Movement leader McHenry Vanani urged government to start paying more attention to specific sectors with much-needed capacity to drive the economy and concentrate on adding value to local commodities. First Rand Namibia on Tuesday officially launched a $3 million Namibian multifaceted internship program aimed to combat youth unemployment and improve youth employability for 20 unemployed Namibian graduates. And Karas Governor Alita Frederick says that the region is open for business, but all business ventures must show balanced interest in people, profit and sustaining the environment. On a similar note, according to the latest report released by Simina Storm, titled Investing in a Decarbonized World, the world is turning to more environmentally conscious, socially cognizant and responsibly governed organizations for investments known as ESG investments. Theo Klein says that even though Namibia has not experienced significant climate change, recent trends on the Namibian Stock Exchange still point towards this philosophy.
Investors want to invest in companies that have very high ESG scores. These companies are expected to outperform other companies with lower ESG scores. Given that the world is moving towards a greener, cleaner environment, companies that are more socially responsible, and of course that have good corporate governance. A lot of factors are driving the inflows into ESG investments in recent years, and these include the very ambitious decarbonization targets that a lot of countries have signed. Another factor driving the large inflows into ESG investments is the fact that women currently are richer than they've ever been in the world's history.
South Africa is seeing ongoing protests, demonstrations and a petition against Shell's planned seismic surveys along the Wild Coast. And in other news, the country's Minister of Home Affairs, Aaron Motsoaledi, says government is working on legislation that would limit the number of foreigners employed by South African industries. Looking further afield, India is set to introduce a new bill that could block many cryptocurrencies in the country, but which could at the same time pave the way for a new government-regulated digital currency. The US, China, Japan, India, South Korea, and the United Kingdom all released stock from their strategic oil reserves in an attempt to tackle current high oil prices. And officials from the US and Taiwan this week held meetings aimed at strengthening